Like music, or do you like technology, or do you like talking to people? CJSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CJSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show, and tons more. To find out more information, visit cjsf.ca.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Aaron Wang, and today I'm joined by my co-hosts, Brandon Brownlee and Tegan Marshall. We are finishing up the series that I have been doing and working through, reading an article from Stanford University on progress and the many different ideas and thinkers that people have come up with to figure out if the human race is progressing, is changing in an incremental way in a positive direction. Now, there are many different ways to think about what is progressing, whether it's your civilization or whether it's what we would call today humanity as a whole or the human race, the human species, and how you define your narrative of progress, so to speak, the story of humanity's progress or your civilization's progress filters through a term that we've unlocked called a universal history. So it's the definitive history that of your people or humanity in question. Now, whether or not there is such a thing as a definitive history of humanity or the human race is somewhat contentious. There are definitely historical facts, but because history is somewhat limited, there are some real questions of whether or not there is such a thing as a universal history for the human race, and that there might be elements of cultural bias that might prevent us from creating a universal, definitive narrative of progress that works for everyone and is academically rigorous enough that everyone would agree to it worldwide. We'll continue looking at John Rawls, who is our current thinker that we're looking through. So John Rawls lived in the 20th century from 1921 to 2002. And he, unlike our Fukuyama, which is the previous thinker we were talking about on the last episode of the show, he never argues that the liberal democratic ideal is the necessary endpoint of historical development. Instead, Rawls' first priority is the justification of a particular conception of liberal justice, one that supports basic political and civic freedoms, and also dictates significant economic redistribution. At the same time, influenced by Kant and Hegel, Rawls is concerned to show that the ideal he describes is possible. By this, he means that it is reachable from the present and, once attained, capable of lasting in perpetuity. He also intends for his demonstration of a just society's possibility to increase its probability. He claims that the Weimar Republic disintegrated into Nazism because its main players lost faith in the idea of a pluralistic society. Rawls defines a well-ordered society as a just society whose members understand, endorse, and act from the principles of justice, and moreover, are aware of each other's attitudes. A well-ordered society is stable if its just institutions nurture rather than thwart the appropriate attitudes in its members. Thus, a stable, well-ordered society is one whose institutions are reproduced over time by informed, morally motivated citizens. Part 3 of A Theory of Justice argues that a society satisfying the Rawlsian liberal principles of justice will be stable. Rawls yokes the question of the persistence of a liberal society to the question of its emergence. Rawls draws on familiar historical events to illustrate how his ideal society could emerge. He notes that freedom of religion started as a modus vivendi, or practical solution, to the wars of religion between Catholics and Protestants. Both groups agreed to the solution because they were exhausted by the fighting, not because they endorsed freedom of religion for its own sake. Yet over time, Europeans came to endorse freedom of religion on deeper grounds than their immediate self-interest. Rawls thinks that political liberalism extends freedom of religion to moral worldviews in general. Thus, he hopes that an analogous path could lead to the emergence of a well-ordered society. Individuals could first choose principles of justice as compromises to persistent moral disagreements, and over time come to endorse such principles for their own sake. Respectful public debate, what Rawls calls the use of public reason, will aid the transformation. Over time, a society of many competing worldviews or reasonable comprehensive doctrines can come to an overlapping consensus on principles of justice governing the public sphere. Other remarks suggest a different path to the same situation. Here, Rawls suggests that his theory is an eminent working out of the ideas already embedded in our public life. This ideological connection to the present should at least facilitate the emergence of a more just society. In this way, Rawls combines optimism and realism, rejecting the doctrine of progress, but emphasizing the possibility of lasting improvement. So we'll stop there for a moment. I think the interesting and unique part of Rawls' perspective is that he sees his ideal of justice as creating a stable society. In other words, there is a permanent ideal of society that is reachable, and that once it has been achieved, should exist basically forever. I think, and we've seen some thinkers articulate this in the past, notably, you could think of Hegel and Marx, but I don't think they formulated it in quite this perspective where you had a society that is fixed in its model and can continuously improve from that model. Hegel's remarks would not, I think, have supported that. He supported the idea that conflict was, in his work, as we discussed briefly, the phenomenology of spirit. Your society develops through conflicts of opposing ideals. So the idea that once you create a stable society with proper institutions that are renewed by morally responsible individuals, that this will create a permanent good society with the possibility of lasting improvement seems to be unique to Rawls. In contrast to Rawls' basic optimism, environmentalists have recently produced some of the most alarming criticisms of the idea of progress. Jared Diamond and Ronald Wright are examples. The authors share three basic theoretical commitments. First, they point to the natural environment as the most important determinant of long-term social stability and change. Next, they appeal to historical examples to argue that change is nonlinear and that environmental variables explain the nonlinearity. Then, extrapolating from past collapses, they argue that recent growth rates should not encourage optimism. Instead, global collapse is a real possibility. Here we get into Jared Diamond's first book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, which was published in 1997. It begins with the Columbian encounter. Diamond asks why the Europeans conquered the Americas rather than the other way around. Assuming the answer lies with Europe's technological advantage over the Americas, Diamond arrives at a second question. Why in the late 15th and early 16th centuries did the Europeans have this advantage? If all prehistoric peoples began roughly at the same starting point, this question implies a third. Why did pre-Columbian rates of technology vary so much worldwide? Appealing to recent research in scientific anthropology, Diamond argues that environmental variation satisfactorily accounts for the corresponding social and technological variation. Diamond defends the thesis that features of the natural environment and the technology they directly enable are the driving forces of long-run development. A direct example for this would be navigable rivers. Europe is home to many easy-to-navigate rivers. The Mediterranean Sea is probably the calmest sea in the world, and so because of that, it's easier rather than on the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans to facilitate shipping and thus to facilitate trade. Rivers reducing the cost of travel and trade creates more communication, more cultural exchange, and also more technological exchange, which is thought to lead to the development of technology. So those geographical advantages could have led to the developments in European technology. Now, they might not be the only advantage that led to European technology, but they are certainly considered one of the primary factors. Wright's A Short History of Progress, 2004, also argues for the primacy of environmental variables, but shifts the focus from differential rates of development. Wright states that what is truly surprising is the similarity among developmental paths in areas isolated from one another. In both Europe and the Americas, we see a movement from illiterate, egalitarian hunter-gatherer societies to complex, hierarchical, agriculturally based ones. At the time of their confrontation, the worlds of the Spanish and Aztecs were more alike than they were different. Wright takes the similarity as strong evidence that universal environmental factors and human needs drive development. The idea that hunter-gatherer societies are egalitarian and what it means for a society to be egalitarian is somewhat disputed between anthropologists and historians. Some people see egalitarian in the sense of there's no ownership restrictions that create what might be called class distinctions. So if you don't have land owners, you can't have one group of people who owns land and one group of people who doesn't, and then have a superior class based off of land ownership. So you could say then that we have hunter-gatherer societies had to be egalitarian because they didn't have such a thing as private property. That's very different from saying, for instance, that hunter-gatherer societies had equal rights for men and women, and equal rights for individuals in general. There's a lot we don't know about early human history. We know that, roughly speaking, it's possible that there were some more hierarchical societies. There might have been more democratically minded societies that had rights for individuals. There might have been some oligarchical societies where small councils of people, such as the idea of having village elders, might have been their method of political experience. It's not 100% clear whether the movement from egalitarian to hierarchical societies is justified historically. The contentions with studying progress is, no matter what perspective you take of how societies are progressing, whether or not that is the objective reality or the true reality, and whether or not we have enough evidence to justifiably believe our conclusions and hold to those and enforce those opinions into the future, into steadfast theories and kind of laws of historical development, is difficult.
I think it is important to see that the pursuit of justice is key to progress. That justice and progress are uniquely linked, because when there is justice, it allows there to be certainty within a society. That here are the structures that direct our movements, direct the way we interact with each other. We see this in the very early philosophical texts of Socrates and Plato in the Republic, right? Socrates is known for posing the question, what is justice? And he's also known for not necessarily giving a definitive answer, because we got a lot of different theories of justice within the Republic. I think the one that was closest to Socrates' heart was doing one's own, or doing one's own work, which didn't mean you didn't engage in public discourse, but it meant you mastered the skill you were naturally suited for. And when you know what you're suited for, you are able then to take that and put it into the public space. For Socrates, the city he creates does not have a hierarchical structure. Glaucon's city does, that is created, and then you get the philosophers as, or the philosophical rulers, and a hierarchical structure there. But it's important, because ultimately, and Hobbes would agree with this, society is a group of individuals that come together for form agreements of, okay, you don't hurt me, I don't hurt you, don't steal my oatmeal, otherwise I'm going to have to hurt you. As Dr. Haiti put in an example recently. I think it's interesting to understand what does justice have to do with progress? Because if we miss that question, I think we miss what progress generally is taken to be.
For Rawls, what is kind of going on in the background is a little bit of the Platonic conception, or at least exploration of it in the Republics. I think you're right to point us in that direction, Tegan, because I know for Rawls, he has a relatively famous thought experiment, the veil of ignorance, where we all establish a society which we would all consent to be established, but we just don't know in what place we would emerge within that society. But it seems relatively compatible with the idea of, okay, well, you have been assigned a place within the society that you have structured and arranged, but it's your job to do that work. That seems compatible with a Platonic conception of justice, of doing one's own work. So he might be incorporating that a bit. I was also going to comment too, I think that there is something, you bring up Hegel and Marx, and that they have a certain endpoint for their conception of progress. But I think that there's actually something a little bit more interesting to draw out between Rawls and the Marx-Hegel duo. And it's that for Hegel and Marx, they see the kind of next step, or for in Marx's case, the end point, as being contained in the present. Rawls sees that too, but it's for a very different reason. With Hegel and Marx, it's because there's an antithesis, there's a thesis and an antithesis, and so naturally you get your synthesis. The kind of next step is contained in the first step. But for Rawls, it's a little different. He says it's ideologically there, that we kind of already are moving towards that. We have public values containing the meaning of civil dialogue, civil discussion, liberality and whatnot. What he sees as, and that's the distinction there between Marx and Hegel, is that for Marx and Hegel, that is a product of conflict between either a synthesis or an antithesis, or a certain result of class war. Whereas for Rawls, he sees it being contained in a very different way. It's not conflict based. It's, well, we don't have to look very far for how our society is going to emerge when something like this does ultimately emerge. We already kind of have the, you know, well-ordered principles that will structure a just society. And that is something like a tolerance of pluralistic existence that is necessary for honest discussions to happen like this. Like, people can't have discussions if they don't actually hold different opinions. So I think he sees that as, I'm drawing a parallel between the two, but it's an interesting difference. It's kind of a subtle difference, but it's interesting to see that it's there.
Yeah, I think that is a crucial distinction. It's definitely a challenge with this series. We go through so many different thinkers, and we're going through it really fast. I guess the analogy that people say is it's kind of like drinking from a fire hose, where everything kind of is way too fast, and you can't really see everything that's going on. So I definitely encourage our listeners to dig deeper in some of these names, perhaps read some of the books we've mentioned. But definitely don't take our words or our comments here as being the definitive explanation for these philosophers and their works, because we're just scratching the surface of a lot of these ideas.
I did want to, there was also something I wanted to comment on the two other thinkers that we were thinking about, Wright and Diamond. And it's interesting for them that there is an environmental factor necessarily inherent in, it seems as though in these two thinkers, an environmental factor explains an apparent difference in the rate or speed of progress. Now, with Wright, it seems that the rate is actually relatively similar between our two, comparisons, the Spaniards and the Indigenous Americans. But the with Diamond, it's a pretty big gap because one ultimately did conquer the other. With Wright, he sees them as more similar. It's interesting to see, well, what environmental factors are they pointing to that explains the given rate of progress? I also, it's maybe a little bit obvious, but it's worth just pointing out that you can point to two different environmental factors and see two different rates of progress. Wright sees, well, they were actually relatively similar. Both of them had incredibly literate cultures, but Diamond is seeing one more technologically advanced than the other, trying to explain differences. So the project, just my very quick assessment of the environmentalists, the environmentalist progressivists or progress theorists, it doesn't seem like environmental factors are going to give you your complete bedrock fact for how to explain differences, because it seems like you can arrive at different rates or kinds of progress based on environmental factors. But I do think it might still be a fruitful project.
It's certainly interesting to consider what factors these authors and these thinkers consider when they create their narratives of progress. Environmental factors can be used in several different ways in terms of describing how societies develop. If you live in a mountainous region, you're more likely to have regional conflicts and less likely to have technological development because you are more isolated from larger groups of people. And you usually will have smaller groups of people because mountains will have a harder time facilitating a larger population growth. Reading from the article again, the trajectory from simplicity to complexity appears linear, but Wright and Diamond argue that appearances are misleading. Looking closely at human history, we can see many instances of collapse. Understanding the cause of circumscribed collapses in the past will foster healthy skepticism about where the human race as a whole is headed. Wright looks at failed societies such as the Kingdom of Ur, ancient Maya and Rome, and Easter Island. Diamond's second book, Collapse, 2005, considers some of the same failures. Failures occur when societies enter a progress trap. A progress trap is a practice that drives environmentally unsustainable growth and is difficult to halt once it is in motion. Although this definition of the term progress trap is due to Wright, Diamond studies essentially the same phenomenon and traces the progress in greater detail than Wright does. Assume the growth of a society is determined by its ability to exploit the natural resources that it possesses. Assume that it will exploit them to its full potential. As the society grows, its ability to exploit its environmental resources increases, which in turn causes it to develop further. Growth is not constant, but accelerating. The society grows exactly up to the point at which its resources are depleted. At that moment, the rate of development and the level of development are at a maximum. Immediately afterward, with the material foundation of society gone, a dramatic collapse occurs. Not only does past growth not mean future growth. The trajectory is virtually discontinuous at the moment of collapse. This trajectory presupposes that the society makes no attempt to renew the resources on which it depends. Diamond isolates factors that explain the blindness, one especially important one being the adherence to dysfunctional value systems. Wright speaks of sticking to entrenched beliefs and practices, robbing the future to pay the present. For Diamond, the factors are changeable by individual and collective acts of will. Unlike Wright, Diamond documents successes as well as failures, societies that recognize and altered their unsustainable practices before it was too late. Historical examples of these include Tokugawa Japan and Tikiopia, an island in the South Pacific. These societies were flexible and farsighted, where unsuccessful ones were rigid and focused on the present. Wright and Diamond see various aspects of the present as dangerous, including the growth of population and pollution, and the depletion of crucial resources. These are features of a civilization immediately before a collapse. Wright and Diamond suggest that increasing interconnectedness means that the globe will succeed as a whole or fail as a whole, but ultimately neither author is a complete environmental determinist or a complete pessimist. Diamond suggests that the same kind of collective rationality that has prevented small-scale collapse can prevent global collapse. Unlike Diamond, Wright is not detailed in his recommendations for change, and his vision of a truly sustainable globe remains murky. But he too thinks that in the next 100 years, individual and group choices will determine whether or not collapse occurs. The idea of progress is complex enough that it has attracted many types of criticism. Some of them seem especially hard to refute. For one thing, the determinism inherent in the idea of progress is difficult to maintain. It is telling that many of the theorists do not incorporate their act of writing and the reception they hope for into a deterministic framework. Second, whether we agree with the precise claims made by Diamond and Wright, it is now clear that the natural limits on growth exist. The exact limits cannot be known for certain unless they are reached, but rather than proceeding as if no environmental limits exist, it is more prudent to estimate the limits and develop policy accordingly. It is better to slow down and come to a halt a few feet before a brick wall than to ignore it and slam into it. For those who reject the idea of progress, for these or other reasons, why care about theories of progress? Not all components of the writings on progress are equally problematic. Three seem especially worthwhile. First, theories of progress draw attention to the power of the Western scientific paradigm. Next, some theorists of progress formulate plausible normative standards for individual domains of human life. Last, the writings on progress contain some of the most powerful statements of the Enlightenment ideals of freedom, equality, and cosmopolitan justice.
I just want to remind our listeners that you are listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. Currently, we are progressing through the final episode of our mini-series on progress.
I have to say, it's been a very wild ride. Learning that Kant was the one who came up with the idea, essentially, for the United Nations, that a federation of republics that guaranteed individual rights would someday lead to world peace. It does seem to me, though, that each of the individual thinkers' ideas on progress are somewhat a reflection of their culture's awareness of their own history and their past history, and also their current circumstances. When we first looked at pre-Enlightenment ideas of progress, when we considered ancient philosophers and thinkers such, and I don't know if it was precisely Plato, Aristotle, and Socrates that we considered, but certainly thinkers in that era, the idea was that their ideas on progress were not necessarily linear or incremental in progress. Instead, they had ideas where you had a golden age where humanity was overseen by the gods. And then you had a silver age where humanity was more on their own, but in decline, and then a bronze age where humanity declined even further, and then an